how, in the definitions that we, okay. And then, of course, if they live in the ADU and rent the primary residence, that would be obvious. But then if we had something like a less than 6 months in 1 day, but if they're in the ADU, so I guess these are just things that we would have to work through. Okay. I think those were my main questions, trying to ferret that out right now. Any other questions before going to public? Councilmember Newsom.
My question goes back to the multifamily residence in our general plan. In our general plan, we changed some of the zonings in our local residential areas where there was single-family zoning on one side and then across the street was multifamily. How are we going to address this if we were to move forward with an ordinance? Would they be grandfathered in, or how are we doing that at the same time as the general plan?
So these standards wouldn't be based on a preference between multifamily and single family zoning. They would differ between a multifamily unit and a single family unit. So there's a lot of single family units in multifamily zoning districts. They'd be treated like a single family unit with these regulations, unless they're an apartment project or multifamily project. So the zoning wouldn't change it unless it's a commercial zone. That's the only that's the only big distinction.
You have a minimum distance determination between multifamily districts, single family districts. Those would be impacted.
The distancing is in the areas that are either less than an acre or greater than an acre, but the distance, the other parameter where there's no distancing for a multifamily project is for a multifamily building, not necessarily a multifamily zoning property. So that's how the distinction is supposed to be.
So the multifamily districts does not apply.
Oh, I see. In the staff report, it does say multifamily districts, doesn't it? I'm looking at the page now.
Yes.
So the intent there is multifamily building, not a multifamily district, because we have a lot of multifamily districts that have single-family homes in them. And so the idea is that you treat a single-family home differently than an apartment building. So I think that's...
And we made changes to
that. It really should say multifamily building on that line. On page,
a multifamily building?
Page 71 of your staff report. My apologies.
And what's... Can you define what a multifamily building is?
Sure. It's a building that has multiple units in it. It may only have two units. It could have 20 units in it.
Do ADUs?
It's in a multi... So our building code actually defines whether a building is a multifamily building or a single-family building. So an ADU in a house is not a multifamily building. A multifamily building is when there's multiple units of the same size and structure that are in a multifamily district. Usually they're four or more. That's typically the layout.
So on some of those multifamily areas or districts, we allow high density development. So if somebody were to knock down their existing building, they could put in a multiplex, correct?
Yes.
A duplex. And then they would have different parameters if they knocked down a single family and built a duplex or triplex.
Yes.
In this regard.
And again, these are only samples in here. So what we're saying is that in a multifamily apartment project, let's say you had 10 units, what we're saying is that in a project like that, you probably should only have one vacation rental. I think we're saying, you know, roughly 5 to 10% or one per multifamily building. And that would be your, essentially set up your distance parameter right there if you limit it to a percentage.
When we were going through the general plan update, we addressed some areas that had issues with trash cans, parking, things like that. They had a high density, weren't able to accommodate the additional traffic. And in this case, if we were to allow a short-term rental ordinance in there, parking would be an impact. Is there certain areas of our town that we wouldn't allow that because we've changed that access?
We haven't gone to that extent of evaluation to say that that would be a significant impact that's different, or we'd have to disallow that in that certain area.
Okay. So, and then the next thing is we do we have a map of the 139 short-term or home shares, or what do we call them? Home shares are pulling the same license as a short-term rental at this time.
We can create a map of where all those rentals are. We don't have that for you tonight.
Okay. Thank you.
Councilmember Harris.
Yeah, just to follow up on, Charles had mentioned about HOAs, and I just wanted to make a comment on that. If, I believe that if complexes, whether it's condos, apartments, or even single-family residential developments that were built 15 to 20 years ago, probably do not address any, I mean, they may address a rental in a certain aspect, but certainly they don't address short-term rentals. So I don't know if this is going to be an issue or what the city can even do about that, but just as notice to anybody watching that if you think this is going to be an issue, the CCNRs would need to be amended, and that's sometimes very difficult to do. But yeah, I know that my HOA CCNRs probably don't address it at all. So thank you.
All right. Any other questions before we go to the public?
Yes. Yeah, I have a quick question. Is it safe to assume that of the 139 units, in terms of the amount of the one generating TOT, that the ones that generate the most are the ones that are, let's say, people that don't live there? Because if they don't live there, their whole purpose of owning it is going to be renting it out. And so yes. Is it safe to say that the bulk of the TOT is coming from, you know, whole house rentals, in effect?
It does appear to be that way when we do random searches and look around on the sites. It does appear that these, you know, a larger luxurious home is, you know, they can rent for $400 a night, and that's going to be a big chunk. Yes.
Right. Well, then I would assume those folks are trying to rent out as much as possible, whereas if I occasionally rent out a guest room, you know, I may not feel, in, you know, compelled to do it very often. And so it would be logical that those whole house rentals are more expensive, and their incentive is to do it as often as possible.
Yes, all the time. A lot of the places are booked all the time. We see that.
Got it.
And they become a permanent vacation house.
Got it. Exactly. Thank you.
All right. We ready to go to public? All right. Go ahead and open up public comment. Any members of the public wishing to speak on this item, please come forward now. Welcome.
Good evening, Council. Jeff Oslin once again. Kudos to Council. This discussion is one of the better discussions that I've heard in the last 14 years going back and forth on any subject, so I appreciate that. I think some great points have been brought up. Distance, 500 feet. Well, 100 yards is 300 feet, so you're into a football field and a half away if you're going to regulate where your short-term rentals can be. For instance, Council Member Derez, you brought up a great point. I could move into my ADU and rent out my house. That might be an option because I can't rent my ADU out because it's after 2020. I'm thrilled that our city manager used another city from this area because the two cities that were brought up are in fiscal dire straits. And I think comparisons to some that are actually more able to understand what they're doing is way better. So another comparison from another city makes more sense rather than the one in the north and the one in the coast. I even believe that we have loaned money to one of those cities to pay their bills at one point. In terms of apartments, I don't want to pick on anybody, but if I went across the street close to a gas station building over there and 40% of those were rented out as short-term rental, I would be upset as a resident here. And the reason I'd be upset as a resident here is this council has discussed numerous times about workforce housing, affordable housing, and we're taking that away if we allow that much in the area because it jacks the prices up. And normally an Airbnb is cheaper than a hotel, and that's why people rent them. It's great that we're getting TOT, but I think we have to be very, very, very careful in what we do there. The best thing that's come out of this discussion is how do we do some form of a regulation so corporations don't buy up all our houses in the city and rent them out, and that really goes back to we would be in trouble again for workforce housing, and we do need that. We do need some reasonable housing. Real quick, I did have an employee whose mother had a house in Atascadero. She did rent out a room frequently, and that's how she was able to continue to pay her mortgage on the house. So I think all these points are valid, but I think there's things to consider, and I think council needs to direct staff to shoot this back again and have a lot more answers and statistics. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Oslin. Any other members of the public wishing to speak on this item? Any at all? All right, seeing none, we'll go ahead and close public comment, bring that back to council for discussion. What I'd like to do is, why don't we pull up, well, first of all, let me ask, do we have a consensus that we should probably have some type of short-term rental ordinance? Let me just get a consensus first, and then we'll, do we have a consensus that we should do some type of, okay, so we've got five of us saying, yes, we should do something. What I'd like to do is start with maybe the first slide that talks about zoning and kind of go through it piece by piece, if that would be okay with you, Director. And Mayor Pro Tem Funk, you had maybe a point or question?
Yes. I wondered if before we dive into the particulars, if we could talk a bit about the goals. Because I think that we have, based on our earlier conversation, that maybe we have some agreement about consensus or across the council about what the goals are. And the goals drive different policy decisions. I think perhaps we prioritize those goals differently. But that there's a lot of, if we're clear about the goals, the why of what we're doing, then it's easier to reach agreements about what's the best way to manage that particular thing for our community, and which things from other communities might not be applicable to us because those communities have different situations and they have different goals for their short-term rental management.
Councilmember Newsom.
I'm in consensus that we do need a short-term rental ordinance, but I don't think that we have all of the information that we need to be able to draft that. And one of those cases is the home shares are pulling the same applications as the short-term rentals. And we don't know what that percentage is. We don't know where they're located in our city, nor do we know if they're investor-owned. So in order for us to make an ordinance, I think we need to have some of that additional data and research done by staff.
Okay. Other thoughts before we
move on to this? Yeah, I kind of concur with Mayor Pro Tem Funk in the sense of, I mean, I'm the one who's asked for more than a few years to have this subject brought before us formally. And I did so with two thoughts in mind, but the primary one, and going to her point, is that if you have a house, you know, a primary residence, let's say there's no ADU on the property, just a house, and somebody owns that house, they don't live there, and they rent it out as a short-term rental, that is a commercial lodging establishment. It's not a house. It's a commercial lodging establishment, also known as a hotel, in a residential neighborhood. And I don't think that's fair to the other neighbors. That's always been my number one concern. On the other hand, I don't believe most of this other stuff is necessary because if you have somebody on site to handle complaints, you don't need minimum distances. You don't need numbers, restricted numbers, et cetera. So my thought is keep it as simple as possible with an end goal of protecting neighbors, neighboring property owners, neighboring homeowners. And so that goes to Mayor Pro Tem Funk's question in terms of what is our purpose.
You literally, like if you made that motion, I would go for that right now. Because what you're doing, I think, when you have a primary residence, and we would have to deal, obviously, with grandfathering and all of that. That's a given. And I know that's a concern of yours, and it's a concern of all of ours, because people have applied for licenses, they've been given a certain right. And even though we're saying going forward, we don't think that's best for our community, they've been given that right. That should not be taken away. So we have to figure out what that grandfathering looks like. But I agree, the goal is, I think, twofold beyond what you said with the neighborhood compatibility, but is also preserving, as Mr. Oslin said, as many of us have said, it is preserving housing stock. And so if you have something where it must be a primary residence or somebody must be on site, you know, they're living in the ADU, renting the primary residence, or they're in the primary residence and they're renting a pre-2020 ADU, that solves a lot of these problems. That's that we exactly don't right. Then need to, have staff doing extra work and charging extra fees and all of that, and, you know, measuring, is it 500 feet or is it 472 feet, and we don't need to worry about that type of thing. So I would say that based on our conversations, those are our two main goals. Are there other goals that you see, Mayor Pro Tem?
Yeah, when I was looking at this, I actually articulated seven things that I think are our goals for this. Preserving of neighborhood quality of life is the number one, and is both the two of you both discussed. And closely related to that, keeping Tascadero authentic in its character as a resident-serving community. allowing our resident owners flexibility, number three, allowing resident owners flexibility in the way they use their properties. Number four being preserving our affordable housing stock. number five being discouraging speculators from buying up properties in our community and converting them to short-term rental use. Six being facilitating the collection of transient occupancy tax for the city. So if the taxes are due, they should be fairly paid. And the seventh would be having something that is enforceable and not something that will be where the spirit of what we're trying to do can be reasonably enforced and not be sabotaged by people who want to game the system.
I think you've taken what we concisely said and drew it out, which is a lovely picture. So I don't think we disagree on much. How is everybody feeling about the basis from which we start to make this?
I think it's not been
make a decision tonight, but give some guidance.
No, I think we're definitely on it, but what I want to make sure it's also addressed is condos and apartments. And you did mention a percentage, I think. But I think what was just discussed here a few seconds ago was about single-family residents and how that's addressed. But apartments and condos needs to be clearly defined on how.
And that's in there as well,
right,
in that 5 to 10. And we can give different direction on that.
Right.
But for
okay.
Sure, that's part of the whole thing. So, yes, Councilmember Newsom.
I think if we're going to require property owners or have someone on the premise, it's going to take some of the rights of other property owners away. And having stayed at multiple Airbnbs and short-term rentals, I've only stayed on one property where a landowner is on site. So we are going to take those rights away from everybody else that chooses to do what they wish with their rental property.
And I think, and this is what Councilmember Borbeau pointed out, is that when you buy a property in a single-family zoning district, you do not have a right to a commercial, you know, to basically having a hotel room. That isn't a right that comes with buying a home in a single-family zoned resident, or a multifamily for that matter. It's something that has started to grow over the last couple of decades, but single-family housing does not come with the property right of renting as a vacation rental, as a hotel room. So I would see that differently.
Can I touch on that a bit?
Hold on.
I want to just touch on it, and then I'm going to let it go. But I'm going to say the reason Airbnbs and short-term rentals came about is due to COVID. Okay? A lot of us wanted to keep our family close. We didn't want to travel and be separated. The second thing that came about with COVID is evictions. We lost, as property owners who have rental properties, lost our rights to evict the tenants. And that has allowed them a safe haven, that has allowed them to not pay rent. For some people, it's been a year. So having the ability to rent with short-term rentals allows you the opportunity to collect revenue on a rental property. It reduces your risks because it's managed by a third party. You screen and you do credit application checks more than you do the single person that walks up to you and says, I want to rent your house. I'm sorry, I have more rights with my property than you do. So when we have an ordinance that requires somebody living on a dwelling that is a primary residence, it is taking the rights to do what we choose to do with a property that we may not have bought as an investment as a commercial hotel. It also takes away our rights to do what we choose with our properties, and we do have a right to rent them.
Councilmember Garris.
And And I want to say, Councilmember Newsom, that I totally agree with you on property rights. I'm 100% behind people having rights for their properties. However, I also agree with what Charles said, or what he touched on earlier about the type of business that you're having, whether you're an architect or you're, you know, whatever it is that you do as your business in the home. Renting the house out as a rental is akin to a hotel. Same thing as if somebody has a large barn on their property, whether it's on a half an acre or 10 acres, whatever. If it's not zoned to be an auto shop, then you do not have the rights as the property owner to say, well, I own this property, I have the rights, I'm renting that out, and somebody's going to put their auto shop in there. And that's not how the system works. It's kind of like I'm saying two different things at the same time. Yeah, I believe in property rights, but I also believe in rules and regulations. And in this case, it's kind of the same thing. Where do we draw the line? Okay, you can use this as a hotel, which is a commercial entity in a non-commercial zone, but your neighbor can't rent the barn to have an auto shop or a wood shop or cabinet shop or whatever it might be. So I think that line needs to be drawn, maybe it needs to be defined a little better and figure out how that's going to get rectified. But there is a similarity, and it's going to possibly open up a can of worms if it's not addressed properly.
And I can certainly understand and appreciate your viewpoint as a property owner and talking to many property owners who have had issues with renting their properties during particularly during COVID, and then you don't have the rental income. Certain people got protected, other people didn't. And when you live in a state like California, we are subject to certain regulations that make it difficult, sometimes feel as impossible to do certain things that maybe in other states you're able to do, particularly as a landowner. So as my predecessor used to say, I'm sorry you live in California. But that's just sometimes how it is, and we're having to deal with that. So Mayor Pro Tem.
I would concur in Councilmember Darris's comments that we're thinking about that. Just because you own this property doesn't mean you can do anything you want with it, including operating a business that's not allowed in that zoning. Your auto shop is a good example. And even if you still live in that house and aren't renting it to someone, you can't decide that now I'm going to run my auto refinishing business out of my driveway and leave all of those smells and odors and things to neighbors. You know, there's a point at which things move from being hobbies to being businesses, and we make those distinctions all the time. And I think the reason, just to take it up to the 10,000 foot level for a second, the reason that this becomes something that we pay attention to with whole house rentals of homes is that this is a use of a property that is profitable to the property owner and creates costs and impacts that largely hit other people, particularly if it's a property owner who is not on site. So if you have a party house, that may generate great revenue for you if you're the owner of the property, but it might be, on the neighbors and be very damaging to the neighborhood quality of life that we're trying to preserve. So we have reasons in terms of our overall goals of what we're trying to do and what we've set out in the general plan to the community we're trying to create to have some balance with this.
Okay.
Mayor, I'd like to address Councilmember Newsom's concern. I mean, and Councilmember Darris and Mayor Pro Tem Funk partially addressed this in regards to, and you did as well, in terms of you don't have an inherent right to turn your property into certain things, whether it's a mechanics garage or a hotel. But as a firm believer in letting people exercise as much property right as possible, I think one of the things we do here is when we get to the question of grandfathering is I would agree that we grandfather in those folks that currently do this. We don't pull the rug out from under them, but we basically provide notice that going forward, you can't buy a house in a Atascadero in a residential neighborhood and turn it into a hotel. So that we're not you know, so you know, buying the house, no, you very clearly do not have the right going forward to turn this property into a hotel. And if you've already done so, we, you know, would consider in the course of an ordinance like this to grandfather that in, because neighbors have property rights too. And I always look at things in terms of what is the reasonable expectation of me buying the property and what's the reasonable expectation of the person next door who, if they did their due diligence, asked, what is this property zoned for? You know, this vacant lot behind me, what is it zoned for, et cetera. And if the answer was, oh, well, your neighbors are all single-family residential lots, then that's what, when I buy the house, that's what I expect to be there. And so I don't think we're taking away a property right, but to be fair to those that have already done this, I would agree to grandfather them in as long as they own that house, and that anybody else buying it knows and understands that Atascadero has a new STR ordinance. That's not allowed anymore.
Councilmember Newsom.
I want to ask a couple more questions since Councilmember Bourbeau brought up some things. I want to talk about unintended consequences. Having vacation rentals and Airbnbs does create jobs. We are about creating jobs, affordable jobs, for those that are cleaners, landscapers, and things like that. So there will be unintended consequences to some additional ordinances. On the basis of those that are already grandfathered in, are you going to allow those that have already pulled applications to be grandfathered?
I think that we need to discuss grandfathering as to the where and the whens and effective dates and that sort of thing. But conceptually, I'm okay with, you know, grandfathering existing things, because I'm not opposed to people doing this. I think it's great if somebody can make some extra revenue to help pay the mortgage, you know, by renting out a guest room or renting out their ADU or, you know, that sort of thing. I'm not against STRs at all, as long as there's an on-site person to handle complaints and keep things under control, and so that essentially it's more of there's a guest in my home or there's a guest on my property. But as far as specifics of grandfathering, I think we'd have to discuss that, the five of us, and see what we come up with.
Okay, so I think what I'm hearing is, certainly Councilmember Bourbeau and I seem to kind of be on the same page with this, and I'm wondering what the rest of you think. Rather than needing to go through the whole zoning and number of feet and things like that, would we have some consensus to have staff look at crafting an ordinance that would be where you have to have, you know, an owner on site or have it be a primary residence? So meaning where, you know, maybe somebody lives there, they go on vacation for a month, you know, somebody stays there for 29 days, to be clear, 29 days, but this person isn't regularly renting the space out, or the home stays, or maybe they live in the ADU, they're renting the primary residence, or vice versa if it's pre-2020, but where we've got either someone on site or it's a primary residence.
I agree. But the primary residence thing, I think, can get a little confusing in that somebody owns a home on the East Coast and one on the West Coast, and they spend, you know, maybe 6 months in each. How do you define which one's a primary residence? I mean, it is a primary residence, but they're here for 6 months, and then, as it was stated, you can't rent it for more than 5 months and 29 days or something to that effect.
Well, so, I think if it's 6 months and one day, we're not the kind of city that pounces on somebody.
But the primary residence, we
come in when you're renting it for 11 and a half months, and you're only here for 2 weeks at Christmas.
But again, you go back to the issue, is there somebody on site to handle complaints? In other words, we live next door, you rent out the whole house, and there's a loud party. I don't want to go, well, hell, Mark's in New York right now. You know, that's the point. It's like, you know, you want to go pound on the door and go, hey.
May I ask, I can hear the council's headed, but there's a little nuance I'm not following. So your primary residence is easy to prove because you certify it through your homeowner's exemption, and your neighbors know you. They know you live there, or you don't. Even in that, usually as part of your annual application process, you designate a responsible person. So if you're not home, your neighbors know, or the police department knows who we can call if there's a problem. So that's part of the annual application process that you designate. So a person living there, does that mean I can have an investor-owned property that I rent long-term, and then they rent out rooms or they can leave? That's I'm not familiar with. I think what you're saying is it's an investor, no investor-owned property. It's your residence, and when you are gone for 3 months, 4 months, there's a person responsible to handle complaints or issues within a certain amount of time they can respond. That's usually how it's handled through the application. Is that what I think you're saying?
Or if you're renting your ADU or you live in the ADU and you're renting out the primary residence, and not, in that case, then you would be on site. And
And the other clarifying question I wanted to ask you about grandfathering. So there's the grandfathering of the right to use your property. Then there's the grandfathering of, there's these operational things we now do in our short-term rental ordinance. Are you grandfathered from those? So I would not recommend that. So if you are an investor-owned property and you're going to grandfather that in, you still would need to do the annual process, pay the annual fee, be subject to, if you put in a complaint measure after a certain number of complaints, you lost your license. I would recommend that that is still subject to all permit holders when you go through your first permit after the ordinance takes effect. So you'd just be grandfathering the use?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
I wanted to clarify that.
And it really sounds like since we have very few problems, that is probably not going to affect many of those property owners, so that's a good thing, but yes.
Yeah. And when I said I want this to be as easy as possible, it's like I do agree, though, that it makes sense to have an initial inspection. We don't currently do that, but I think that makes sense even just for life and safety, that people aren't renting out illegally converted garages and, unfinished attics and whatever, but then that, that we don't need an annual inspection, maybe 3 years or 5 years or something. We want to keep this fee low. We're not trying to discourage people from making this good additional use of their property, just trying to discourage the concept of a hotel in a private neighborhood. But there are a few new things, and you're right, grandfathered properties would have to comply with the, quote, new rules, in the sense of, making an application, paying an annual fee. That's right. And I don't believe we need to do any of this minimum number of stays, because if somebody, every year decides they want to rent out their house on Cal Poly weekend or their ADU or all of their bedrooms or whatever, except for one, more power to them.
Yeah.
We shouldn't say, oh, no,
they're
you got to
stay with a friend in Itasca there.
Well, yeah.
Someone else will stay in the friend in north of here and then rent out their whole house. Why not? As long as someone's there to.
Regard to minimum number of stays, I think that comes into play if we allow this as a use and if we restrict how many licenses can be done, particularly within a given period. Then I think we, in order to keep somebody from gaming the system, then they actually have to use it.
I think that what we're talking about actually means that we don't need a cap. I think this, what we're talking about, takes care of a lot of the problems that we've been discussing.
I think so. I do think we should be mindful of multifamily units as well, because while I think all of us are homeowners and have the benefit of being in a neighborhood where we expect everybody else to not have a commercial building, that those who live in apartments are not expecting a hotel to be next door. Either they're also expecting a neighbor, not a hotel. And there's
correct.
There's a reasonable expectation.
You are correct. We've talked about that.
We should, that should be, and that is particularly our most important affordable housing stock to make available to people, so that young people who are developing their careers in the community have a place to live.
So let's pull up. Director, did you have I think your recommendation was somewhere in the 5 to 10% range for multifamily. Do you have a slide for that, or is that more just discussion?
It's in your staff report. I don't have a slide for that.
Okay.
But it is on page 71 of your staff report, where there's a discussion under multifamily that, we threw out some numbers that somewhere between 5 and 10%, which would roughly be one per 10-unit apartment,
with a minimum
for example.
Of one unit for anything that
at
has
least
less
one
than
unit.
10.
Yeah.
Okay. And then kind of keeping that commercial at 40%. That's kind of what it's been citywide for some time.
Yes.
Okay.
Just one thing that, for clarification, if I can, because it popped in my head. Certain properties, somebody might own several properties together, but they use it as one single property. So you have three APN numbers, but you've got your main house, and basically you're kind of spread out. I mean, is that going to be an issue with defining the main? I don't think that's going to be an issue, right?
That wouldn't be an issue if we have an ordinance that says primary.
Just primary
is one house.
Right. So it doesn't matter about the other two APN numbers because you're just talking about the residence. That's, yeah. All right. Thanks.
But I think the idea is you could be living in the primary residence and rent out the others as long as it's not after 2020.
Oh, in terms of ADUs, you're speaking, correct.
Oh, were you talking about just three separate single-family residents, or are you talking about
No. Just if you have three lots together, maybe there are three narrow lots,
whatever it is,
and you have a house on it, whatever.
Got it. Okay. Totally different. Mayor Pro Tem Funk, followed by Councilmember Newsom.
Sure. Coming back to the commercial zoning district, for multifamily that's in that commercial zoning, my understanding is that the 40% is not related to any of the kinds of goals that 40% is a current practice, right? It's the only current limit we have, right?
Yes, and it's solely related to building code. It's because of the fact that once you have a greater proportion of the units as vacation rentals, then really technically it's a hotel, it's a motel, and technically it has different code standards. And so that was something that was developed by our former building official. It's not specifically tied to a state or local law or anything else.
Yeah, okay. So what I'm hearing there is that the purpose of that is not related to the kind of goals we're talking about neighborhood quality preservation or affordable housing stock retention or keeping the authenticity of our community.
But actually, Director, could you clarify? Because I think I know where you're going, Mayor Pro Tem.
So
we're talking commercial, like downtown. We're not talking a neighborhood with an apartment complex.
So
could be 40%.
Take La Plaza, for example. La Plaza is a commercial district. It has 42 residential units in it right now. There are some vacation rentals in La Plaza right now. So what we're saying is if, 20 of those units wanted to convert to vacation rentals, under our current policy, that would be allowed. Now, if we went to something that said you can't do anything outside of a primary residence, that would probably change dramatically over the years in La Plaza. That would be a whole different thing, and that would regulate itself.
Yeah.
Unless you didn't have commercial districts under that primary residence rule, because mixed-use projects are different. They are a different animal. And oftentimes, mixed-use projects are next door to a hotel or above a hotel or within a hotel. They're a commercial property. They have a different standard. They're not a neighborhood. They're usually vertical, high-rise projects.
Right, but you're not necessarily, even in a mixed-use project, you're not necessarily expecting it to be a hotel.
You're not. It has different, you have neighbors. You do have people that live there long term. And you create a neighborhood in itself in that project. And that's what La Plaza has become, for example.
Yeah. And La Plaza would be a good example of something that as we're looking at our grandfathering. How do we do that? But if you look at the future of the downtown that we're envisioning over downtown area over the next 20 years of this community that we see in the building plan, I don't see us wanting that to be 40%, up to 40% short-term rentals. And have all of the variability that goes with that. That we're looking to create a more residential environment with it. And so I think that we should be attentive to commercial zoning districts as well as multifamily in having some restrictions in order to preserve the quality of life that we're attempting to create in those environments.
I think my concern with the commercial aspect of it is oftentimes when somebody is coming in and being willing to put their put their money, blood, sweat, tears into a project like La Plaza to take away that ability to do the STRs could limit the financial viability of it. So that concerns me a little bit. That could not be the case, but you know, possibly something that we look into as we're, because we're not saying, hey, come back next month with this at 40% or this at 20%, but I think that's something that we could look at. I have a feeling that this will come back maybe a couple of times, not just one and
yeah.
done.
Yeah.
So
there's,
I think
there's a bit of work here.
Yeah.
yeah. But I mean, keep in mind, too, with a commercial property, I mean, La Plaza could come in tomorrow and say, you know what, we've decided we're going to turn into a hotel. And they could do that by simply putting a couple different fire alarms and exits in there, and it'd be allowed by zoning, and we wouldn't have a whole lot to say about it. It's kind of an interesting thought. So,
well, I think I agree with the concern that Mayor Pro Tem Funk raised, but I would agree with the analysis that the mayor provided, that I'm not sure what it would do to commercial viability of some of these things, because offhand, 40% does seem too high to me, but I'd like to, you know, hear from the folks who build these kind of things what that impact is, and you know, what they gain from that flexibility. Are they actually using that flexibility at La Plaza? But I think it's a valid concern to raise. And as the mayor noted, we don't have to decide on 40 or 20 or 30 or 10 tonight. We can, but it's an issue we need to get some more detail on before we would make a decision.
Mayor, if I may, to help move this along, I think we can certainly get more information on that in our next report. Remember, tonight was just even yep. trying to figure out, are we interested? Our next meeting would have more noticing, more input.
Right.
But I do think we should, so on that we got it. On the multifamily residential product, a council member said we should preserve that for rental housing. It seemed a few of you were kind of nodding your head, but that would be helpful direction to get tonight to address that further or not address that when we come back.
Let me have Councilmember Newsom has been patiently waiting.
No worries. I was just going to make a recommendation to staff as we're having this conversation back and forth about primary residents, primary residing on site, is that perhaps, as other jurisdictions do, they require a 24-hour property management company. It does not allow investors to own it, and that it's an actual person that resides locally that manages the property. I do want it to be not very complex. I don't want to lose our TOT, and that's why I was worried about the public outreach to understand how this is going to impact. So as you're doing that feedback, and then the only other thing I want to add is when we looked over at the comparison to the other jurisdictions, none of them had a minimum stay requirement. We do not want to be the most restrictive city with the least amount of information of how it's split between home shares. So as you're bringing it back, I think it's important to look at all of these key aspects and to also make sure that we're addressing the general plan update, because we did change some overlays and adjust some housing and density requirements in some areas throughout our community.
And I think that well taken with the general plan update, but I think the minimum stays, I would agree, we don't want to be restrictive, we want this to be easy. And I think if we're talking primary residents or residents on site, meaning they live in the ADU, they're renting the primary, they're in the primary and they rent the ADU, I don't think the minimum stay is an issue. And as Councilmember Bourbeau said, you don't want, you know, someone says, oh, Cal Poly weekend, you know, I'm going to rent out my whole house, you know, great. We don't want to say that you can't do it just once. You have to do it 10 times if you're going to do it at all. But if we have these parameters in place, it takes care of a lot of those issues. So being that we don't have to nail anything more down tonight, I'm going to ask staff, do you feel like in this discussion you have a good understanding of where we'd like to see this go, and of course then the outreach to the, you know, to the current short-term rental folks and others for future meetings?
Primary is what I've heard.
and multifamily, you know, maybe looking in that
primary, but otherwise keep it easy and simple.
Keep it easy and simple.
Looking at the commercial aspect,
and
talking with folks
and
about
bring
that.
Back some more statistics about what's out there today. Yeah. Do outreach to everybody that's out there today so they can be part of this conversation.
Yes.
And I think, unless there was anything else, I think.
Thank you for your hard work.
Yeah. I do think as we do outreach to folks who are using their properties as short-term rentals, that we make an effort to reach out to people who are neighbors of properties that are being used as short-term rentals, so that we are hearing a full picture of this and not just one side of the equation, but getting a fuller understanding. And let everybody, let us get
got it.
Everybody's
clear.
Best ideas
got it.
At the table.
All right. Are we good to go? All right. We are done with that item. Excellent. Do we need a motion, or it was just giving you information, right?
Just a discussion.
We're good.
Tonight,
that's what I thought. Okay. How are we doing? Do we need a break, or do we want to go on to purchasing policy? Okay. So we're going to go on to purchasing policy number two with our administrative services director, Ms. Jerry Rangel.
Thank you very much, Mayor and Council. Tonight we are going to review the purchasing policy, We did get an opportunity to go over this with the Finance Committee, so they did get a very thorough review of this, and I appreciate all the efforts from the Finance Committee for their work on this as well. Okay, so the purchasing policy, just in general, is kind of an overview. It provides guidelines for our city purchases. So we try to get the best value with the funds available. We want to ensure fair and open competition, and we want to be consistent with applicable laws and regulations. The policy is reviewed and amended periodically as needed to reflect those practices. And as I said, it was thoroughly reviewed by the Finance Committee. The bulk of the purchasing policy really stayed the same. However, I wanted to call a few of the changes to your attention. In April of this year, the council adopted a digital signature policy, and so this purchasing policy adds a little section kind of clarifying language that was added to reflect that change in the digital signature policy that the council added earlier in the year. The California Public Contract Code amounts change periodically, so these amounts in this current red line draft here have been updated to the current amounts. We do reference the California Public Contract Code in the policy, so even if they would change after this, they would still be the current numbers that are affected there. So it can still remain current in between updates. And we also added an entire full section on design build procurement. We really hope to use this method to build our fire station and our EOC and the other public safety facilities, and expect that this will save the city both time and money for those projects. It's a very lengthy section. It's kind of hard to read and get through, but for very good reason. There's, as you can imagine, a lot of compliance and everything that we need to get through, and city attorney has assured us that all of this is very important to be in compliance. So, and we have updated the travel policy as well to streamline, clarify, and modernize our language in there. We really encourage our employees to go to trainings and professional conferences to really keep up their skills and make sure that they're knowledgeable and proficient. The goals of the travel update changes are to make it easier to understand and follow the policy for all of us, to continue to keep travel costs low, and to improve the management review of those costs and reimbursement claims. And with that, I'd be happy to address any questions you have.
Thank you, Director. Any questions for Director Rangel? Oh, I'm not seeing any questions.
Oh. I was going to make a comment when we get the comments.
just on the design build standards, Did we make an effort to model these design-build standards on what we see as best practice in well-managed cities through contexts such as the League of California Cities?
Yes, we did get some very great help from our city attorney on this this section, and there is a lot that we have to be in compliance with on the state. So they are best practices and in line with state law. I don't know if our city attorney wants to add any additional.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that for many years, general law cities such as Atascadero did not have the ability to do design build. It was reserved to charter cities. The legislature has been slowly letting out the leash on that one for general law cities, and the experience has been that it produces better projects at a lower cost, and so the legislature has expanded the opportunities for general law cities to engage in design build. We're taking advantage of that process right now with the public safety facility. Having had that experience, a lot of general law cities have come up with best practices on how to manage that. So we not only learned from those opportunities, we learned from the experience of charter cities in doing those projects as well.
Great, thank you. One other question, and that is for these design build contracts where that is, these tend to be, of course, larger value contracts. Does the same change order limit apply? I was noticing in other contracts that the city manager can do a change order for up to 25% of the cost of the project, as long as it's under that limit. And I just wondered if that same breakpoint applies as to design build.
That is a great question, and I don't know that we built that into that section. It would be our intention that would be consistent throughout the policy, and certainly anything that was very significant or had a large change to a project, the staff would come back to the council for direction and or additional budget adjustment if we got to that point.
Okay.
And if I could point out, one of the advantages of design build is that the designer is building and can anticipate what those change orders would be. So design build projects have a much lower incidence of change orders necessary because they've already built that into their underlying price.
Question?
Well, now I have a question, actually. because I thought in our, because we discussed this for this and the investment policy, which we approved or discussed last week and approved on the consent calendar this evening.
The point on having you on the Finance Committee is you wouldn't have a question.
You're right. So we discussed it for this for almost 2.5 hours in total, so we were very thorough. But I thought we did discuss the issue raised by Mayor Pro Tem Funk regarding, you know, the city manager has a certain a contract award authority, but that a 10% change order on a very large design build contract would greatly exceed that. We kind of discussed that, but I'm forgetting where we ended up on that, and I don't see it off the top of my head.
Where we ended up is the authority I have is in the policy. While that's the authority, that doesn't mean that's the pragmatic thing. If there's a $2 million change order, I would not see a situation where I don't come to you to talk to you about that. And there was really an error in the scope or something at that point. So we had talked about while that authority may exist, it's not in the best interest of this city manager to do something like that without coming to the council.
Plus the budgetary, you'd have to really come for the budgetary authority.
Because
to spend
that's right,
the
because you've already given
so,
that.
I think that was the answer.
And then we talked about, you know, emergency or odd circumstances that could delay the project, and so you left it in there knowing that the city manager should have discretion to come to you if there's time.
Got it. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank staff, Mr. Fleischman. I mean, my head hurt when I read through that.
And I want to add that.
So glad there's people that do that.
It's a very thorough
work.
Meeting and somewhat unusually, I had less questions than Councilmember Newsom. She was very thorough in questioning.
I heard she was responsible for some of the changes too. Yeah. So thank you both for your time and commitment to that. All right, with that, we'll go ahead and open up to public comment. Any member of the public wishing to address the council on this item? I am seeing none. We'll go ahead and close public comment, and I'll bring that back for a motion.
Well, actually, I did have a comment. Wasn't a question, so it was a comment.
Why don't you comment and then make a motion?
Yeah, I will do that. On page 159 of our agenda packet, when we talk about travel expense reimbursement, we talk about under certain circumstances, the city manager may authorize something other than the cheapest seat in order to, you know, be able to, for people to, on the executive team and the city manager to be able to work on a plane. And it said it includes eligible members of the city council. And, you know, I always think that city council should probably apply the cheapest thing available. And since we make less than minimum wage, we are not highly paid executive employees. And so I was going to suggest that we not include the city council in that particular provision.
All right.
Another way I would move the approval of the policy as presented, with deleting the city council on that one.
I would not want to delete the city council on that
okay.
one. The lowest fare is sometimes the fare that can be canceled at the last minute and you can't make it. So, no, I don't think an extra $39 or something is going to break our budget for a council member to fly on a shared seat.
It's not going to break the budget. It's more a matter of appearance, if you will, about us, including us, giving us an exception, rather.
I'll second.
So I wouldn't support a motion with it being removed.
Okay, then I'll withdraw the motion. Let somebody else make the motion.
Okay.
I'll make the motion to approve it as written.
A second?
I'll second.
A motion by Councilmember Newsom, a second by Councilmember Darroze. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Borbo.
Yes.
Councilmember Darroze.
Yes.
Councilmember Newsom.
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Funk?
Yes.
Mayor Moreno?
Yes, ma'am.
Motion passes unanimously.
Thank you. All right. Still ready to move on without a break? How are we doing? Yeah? All right. We'll move on to our final management report of the Atascadero Chamber of Commerce contract for fiscal years 2025-2027. And this will be our city manager, Mr. Lewis.
Thank you, Mayor and members of council. I'll start it out and then I'll turn it over to Lorelei Cathelord, Deputy Director for Economic Development. I first want to share that the city enjoys an excellent relationship with its Chamber of Commerce, and I think that unfortunately is unique in California cities, and so I think we really enjoy, and I want to thank Mr. Cross, the CEO, and his board for the good work they do in our community, and that's why agreements like this are even possible, right? We've had an exceptional run, and they've done excellent work for us that Ms. Kappel will talk about in just a moment. And so the council had asked to look at this again. Were there other products and projects that the chamber could work on? And so Mr. Cross and his team met with me and Lorelei, and we collaboratively worked through agreement, which we'll share with you tonight. But I did want to, this is a great agreement. It's probably, it is the strongest Chamber of Commerce I've worked with in 26 years in municipal government, and we don't take that for granted. So thank you, sir, for the work you and your team do. So before you tonight is a new agreement at the same value of what we pay the chamber now. Again, to credit the chamber, they'd recognize that much of the work we've been asking them to do was completed, which you'll hear in just a minute. And so they said, well, are there other things you'd like to collaborate on that we could do? And so that's the basis of what's before you tonight. But I will turn it over to Ms. Kappel to talk through the successes of our current agreement, and then I'll share where we're headed in the future.
Great. Thank you, Jim. All right, so let's talk a little bit about the existing or the past contributions that the chamber has made. So kind of going through this with the chamber in preparation for this new scope of work, we've gone through some of the things that have been accomplished. And I think it's important to note, and Josh says this well when he talks about chambers, the role of chambers has evolved greatly. It used to be about planning parties and hosting events primarily, and just really about exposure and networking. And our chamber specifically has changed from the 3 P's, parades, pageants, and parties, as chambers across the nation typically used to do, to the 3 C's, which is the convener, champion, and catalyst for businesses. So I think they've done a really great job of hearing the call of what is the new role of chambers and really pivoting in Atascadero for economic development. So here's some of the things that they've done that have contributed greatly to our community, but also have been important to our city as a whole. So Bridgeworks co-working space, it's really important to note that this has provided over 28 head of household jobs since they've created a co-working space at the Chamber of Commerce. They rent desks, they have private office space, they have conference rooms with high definition, high internet speed fiber for all of those people that are commuting or telecommuting from their homes in Atascadero. And they brought them together. They've created an environment where it's inspiring. They can have coffee together and meet. And that's been really advantageous, especially as one of our council's goals is to create quality jobs and create an ecosystem for that. Women of Influence North County, you were all at the event last month or earlier this month. And that's a really interesting and really important thing. And it's been sold out for the last couple years, noting that it's shows and underscores the importance of elevating women in our region and talking about the accomplishments and the great work they're doing in the community. We also have seen that the Chamber has retooled the State of North County, which used to be an event that was